We're back with All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Guy Raz. A few days ago, I was on the edge of the Potomac River in Maryland, coating my pants with insect repellent.
Stay off, bugs.
I was following John Kress, he's a botanist at the Smithsonian Institution, through a dense forest of tulip poplars, maple trees, and spice bush. We were on our way to an obscure little island just a few miles upstream from Washington, D.C. It's called Plumber's Island, and it's the place where the quest to sequence the DNA of every single plant species on Earth began.
Sorry, a little overgrown.
After about 15 minutes, we stop at the edge of the Potomac. The water is low, and the channel separating the mainland from Plumber's Island is just a few feet wide. So John Kress leads the way as we scamper over some rocks and onto the island.
So here we are at the Welcome to Plumber's Island sign, the most thoroughly studied island in North America.
And that is a fact.
This is a fact.
The most thoroughly studied island in North America.
There's been more biologists out here looking at everything from worms to flowers to birds to mammals to snails than any other spot on the East Coast.
All on these 12 acres.
All on these 12 acres.
It's a strange little island, peaceful, serene, isolated, and yet it sits directly under the flight path from Dulles Airport and right below the busy Capitol Beltway. John Kress comes here at least once a month. Now, much of his research on plant life has taken him to more exotic places like Burma and Ecuador, places with far more biodiversity than Plumber's Island. But it's here, on this tiny little patch of land in Maryland, where a microclimate creates an unusual environment.
You think of the temperate zone, the mid-Atlantic forest with oaks and maples and things. What we're standing right now, we're surrounded by tropical plants. The pawpaws are in the tropical family Annonaceae. The spice bush is in the tropical family, the Lauraceae or the laurels. And so when I look at here, I feel like I'm in Costa Rica sometimes, because it's just the sorts of things I'd see if I was in a lowland tropical forest in Central America. Of course, the big trees are not really tropical. They're the oaks, they're the maples, they're the walnuts. But when I'm here, particularly in the heat of the summer, it really feels like the tropics.
Are these native to this area?
They're native. In fact, the pawpaws are probably also fruiting right now. We might find some pawpaw fruits around.
Can you eat it?
You can eat it. They're good.
Kress leads me up a narrow path to the highest point on the island. At the top sits an old ramshackle wood cabin. The cabin is the clubhouse for a super exclusive fraternity called the Washington Biologists Field Club. It's been around for about 100 years, and membership is strictly limited. There are only 65 spots. And even with his distinguished record of research, John Kress didn't get in until 10 years ago.
As members pass on, we have new members, younger members.
So you can't expand?
We've never expanded.
Right. So in order to become a member, somebody has to pass away.
Or leave the area and resign their membership, which is rare.
So this has got to be one of the toughest clubs in the city to get into.
I'm probably not going to comment on that.
The members are the stewards of the island. They actually owned it until a few years ago when they donated it to the federal government. Outside the cabin, Kress fills me in on a project that could potentially revolutionize the way we understand plants.
What we were doing on Plumber's Island was using it as a pilot study for something we want to take to the tropics and take to forests all around the world, which is developing a system of identification based upon the DNA of a species. This DNA marker we call a DNA barcode. And that's essentially taking a small segment of DNA that we can find in all organisms. We have to locate it on a certain part of the genome. But it's variable enough that it's different for all species on the planet. And then we can take any sort of part of a plant, or take a hair or a leg of a grasshopper, grind it up, get out the DNA, sequence this little chunk of DNA, and then tell what species that is.
The barcode he's talking about isn't a literal barcode like a UPC symbol on a cereal box. It's a code that's inside the plant.
The DNA is inside the trees, inside the plants, and we extract that DNA, and then we have to sequence that DNA to actually identify the plant. So we're not there yet in terms of me picking a leaf off the ground and telling you immediately from its DNA barcode what that is, we would have to take it back to the lab,
right,
sequence it. But technology is heading in the direction where we expect what now sits on the top of a desk as a DNA sequencer will eventually fit in the palm of your hand.
So like an iPhone or
like
something.
Like an iPhone, cell phone.
Within a few years, John Kress imagines kids wandering through forests around the world with portable scanners that could analyze a sample of any plant, check it against the DNA database he's creating, and know within a few seconds what species they're looking at. But to get closer to that future, we have to get off the island and into the lab. So we drive about 30 minutes to Suitland, Maryland, home of the Smithsonian Museum Support Center. It's a giant campus where the Smithsonian stores all the stuff you don't see in the museums. And it also hosts dozens of research labs.
The affectionate name for the Museum Support Center is the Death Star.
The scientists call it the Death Star because it's one of the cleanest places you've ever seen. Spotless.
Okay, everybody sign in. I just need a photo ID.
We're here to meet Kress's partner in the DNA barcoding project. His name's Dave Erickson. Dave is the guy who collects all the plant samples sent to him from around the world, including the samples collected on Plummer's Island.
And we take literally two hole punches out, and that's the source of all the DNA that we'll use.
Two hole punches?
Two hole punches. And that is more than enough DNA to do all the sequencing we're going to use. In fact, it's so much DNA that we can preserve that for whole genome sequencing down the future if we get to that.
Once the samples come in, Erickson grinds them up and sends them to a DNA extractor. Eventually, the plant's DNA is analyzed and the data from the specific gene is converted into that DNA barcode. And that barcode is what goes into the DNA database at the center.
Anybody who wants to go to Plummer's Island, or in theory, as we extend this to all plants, anywhere, collect a plant in any kind of forensic context, the technology for extracting the DNA and sequencing that is ubiquitous. So let's say there's a kid in a hospital, he's sick, he barfs up some stuff, they can recover that fragment of leaf tissue that he ate, do a DNA extraction. Because we have a reference library at this defined set of genes, they know exactly what gene they need to target and sequence. Once they do that, they can figure out what this kid ate. Okay, so the power of the reference library is that it's the same gene. Everybody knows what it is. It's easy to recover in a lot of different environments and contexts.
Similar plant species might have very important differences, like one strain might be poisonous and one might not be. Right now, when scientists need to distinguish between two different species of plants that might appear identical to the naked eye, they have to wait until those plants produce fruits or flowers, and that could take up to half a year. Back on Plummer's Island, John Kress says that future, when people will know instantly what plant they're looking at, is still a bit far away. There are literally millions of plant species to sequence, and then thousands more yet to be discovered. But at least here, on these 12 acres in the middle of the Potomac, the job is complete.
It's pretty amazing to walk through here and know that we have a DNA barcode for every plant that's out here.
Every single thing.
Everything.
If you'd like to see photos of Plummer's Island and the lab at the Smithsonian's Museum Support Center, visit our website at npr.org. One of the great sports writers of his day inspired this.
My time of day is the dark time, a couple of deals before dawn, when the street belongs to the cop and the janitor with a mop.
Few people made the streets of New York sing like Damon Runyon. He was born 125 years ago today in, appropriately enough, Manhattan, Kansas. Runyon spent years as a sports writer covering boxing and baseball for the Hearst newspapers, but he's best remembered for his short stories about the tough guys and crooks who populated Broadway in the years before the Second World War. Two of those stories were turned into the musical Guys and Dolls, taking characters like Skye Masterson and Nathan Detroit from the depths of Broadway to its glittering heights. Here's Marlon Brando as Sky, passing on a choice bit of advice from the 1955 movie version of the play.
One of these days in your travels, a guy is going to show you a brand new deck of cards on which the seal is not yet broken. Then this guy is going to offer to bet you that he can make the jack of spades jump out of this brand new deck of cards and squirt cider in your ear. But son, you do not accept this bet, because as sure as you stand there, you're going to wind up with an ear full of cider.
Author Jimmy Breslin wrote a biography of Damon Runyon. He says Runyon based characters like Sky and Nathan on people he actually knew.
They were real. It was the street reporting, and there would be people all over those streets, and they were great characters.
This horse thief is called Horsey for short, and he is not called by this name because he ever steals a horse, but because it is the consensus of public opinion from coast to coast that he may steal one if the opportunity presents.
That's actor John Shea introducing us to Horsey the horse thief from Runyon's story, A Piece of Pie. Runyon's characters were certainly memorable, but his language even more so, a poetic jumble of $10 words and an eternal present tense that sticks in your head long after you've put down one of his books. Damon Runyon died in 1946, 4 years before Guys and Dolls hit Broadway. And according to Jimmy Breslin, the news business hasn't been the same since.
There's a long blanket of dullness. You tell me something in a newspaper you read that makes you laugh.
Yes, sir, when you see a guy reach for stars in the sky, you can bet that he's doing it for some doll.
That's Jimmy Breslin on Damon Runyon. He was born 125 years ago today.
Speaking of banks, if you bounce a check, use the wrong ATM machine, or fail to keep enough money in your account, who does that? You'll pay dearly. A new study finds that banks continue to rake in the fees, but changes are on the way. NPR's Wendy Kaufman has more.
Banks bring in tens of billions of dollars each year, and Bankrate, a company that keeps tabs on the industry, says those fees rose again in 2009. Overdraft charges are often the most expensive and sometimes come as a complete surprise.
So we asked consumers, if you had $25 in your checking account and you tried to take $40 out of the ATM, what do you think would happen?
Lauren Bown of Consumers Union says nearly half of those asked thought the request would be denied. Not enough money, no ATM cash. But most of the time, you'll get the cash, along with a hefty fee for overdrawing your account. Bob Mira, a senior banking analyst at the consulting firm Salent, says overdraft fees might also apply if you use a debit card to buy a morning coffee.
A $4 latte at Starbucks could overdraft an account by 50 cents and produce a $35 overdraft fee. So now the $4 latte is $40.
And overdraft fees can be assessed multiple times on the same day. Banks typically enroll consumers in overdraft plans, but often the customers don't know it. That practice has prompted an outcry. Consumer advocates want people to be able to choose whether to have overdraft coverage or not. Federal regulations to do that have been proposed. With regulation looming, some of the nation's largest banks announced plans to let consumers opt in or out. And they announced some changes in when fees would be assessed. The vast majority of overdraft fees are incurred by a relatively small number of customers. And says Bob Mira,
I think lost in the debate is the idea that these fees are 100% avoidable.
Still, they are often paid by those who can least afford them. In addition to overdrafts, banks often charge a fee if minimum balances on free checking accounts fall too low. And says Greg McBride of Bankrate.com, banks charge for using ATMs that don't belong to them.
Particularly on small withdrawals, going to the wrong ATM can cost you a pretty penny and take a good chunk out of the withdrawal that you're making.
There are usually two fees, one from your bank and one from the ATM owner. The latter is called a surcharge, and it averages well over $2 per withdrawal. You pay that, says McBride, even if you only take out $20.
If you're really in a pinch, use the debit card at the point of sale and get cash back.
Just be sure you won't get an overdraft charge in the process. Federal Reserve proposals for overdrafts are still pending. Meanwhile, Congress is also contemplating a crackdown on banking fees. Wendy Kaufman, NPR News.
You're listening to NPR News. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Jackie Lydon. Music has long been a vehicle for social change, and with the increased use of digital technology, music and activism are interacting in new ways. Scott Goodsting has been at the forefront of this emerging landscape. He developed the winning social networking strategy for then-Senator Barack Obama's presidential campaign. He now runs Revolution Messaging, a company that develops mobile and social media marketing plans for nonprofit groups. He's in Washington speaking at the Future of Music Coalition's Policy Summit. It's an annual gathering focused on technology, copyright issues, and music. And Scott Goodsting joins us now in our studios. Thanks for coming in.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Busy man.
Yeah, it's been fun.
At the beginning of your career, you worked in both music promoting and political organizing. What did you learn from the world of music that you translated into political action?
I realized that when doing lifestyle marketing for musicians, that it was a deeper connection because folks that were coming out to shows or hanging out and talking in a bar or a tattoo parlor or a skate shop about their music really felt connected to one another as a neighborhood or as a community. And I felt that powerful connection mostly out of the D.C. punk rock scene and realized that there was something very powerful in community organizing within that structure, and realized that that was what it was missing in the campaigns that I had been managing.
You wanted to translate the connection people felt into something that politicians could use. What do you think politicians have learned from that?
Well, originally, in 2004, I partnered up with a gentleman named Fat Mike from NoFX to create something called Punk Voter. And the politicians were afraid of us. And the politicians didn't know what to make of folks trying to organize in different communities, or feared, you know, these kids with different hair colors, didn't realize that these kids were fearing the same things that they were talking about. And while they looked different, maybe had different hair color, or were hanging out in different places, they were still dealing with credit card debt, worrying about the economy. And so we sort of organized outside the campaign. It was an honor this time around to actually bring some of those organizing tactics inside the campaign versus trying to organize all this at your local skate shops and nightclubs outside the campaign with no connection.
I'm going to talk about Barack Obama in a moment, but you mentioned that you hooked up with this guy, Fat Mike. What did that teach you about the message? What message did you come up with?
A lot of these musicians understood politics and messaging in a smarter, more sophisticated way than people in D.C. who, you know, claim to have studied politics and media and messaging.
Is that because of writing song lyrics, for
I think
example?
Both writing song lyrics and also just talking to average voters every single day. Most of the musicians that were involved with Punk Voter were small business organizations. They run their band, they run their record label, they're touring, they have to understand how to sell merchandise, and are amazing promoters and performers. So to explain to them how to craft a message in 30 seconds, they understood that. And so I learned to listen to these musicians and realize that they had their own take and their own reflection on society. And I guess it shouldn't shock anyone because essentially that's what they're doing with their music, reflecting on society in their own unique way.
You consult with creative people. I'm just curious, do they ever say, listen, I love what Twitter can do for me, but if I do it too much, I won't be creative?
You know, it's such a tool that's still, I think, in its infancy that there's all sorts of interesting experiments. Some politicians are doing extreme personal stories. Senator Claire McCaskill from Missouri. Is been writing about when her kids are coming home and when she has to work out. And then she's also writing about the fight for getting government money into her district. And so I'm not from Missouri. I don't know much about Missouri, but I think it's definitely brought me a closer connection to her.
In helping to create Barack Obama's highly successful social messaging campaign, which really had never been used in quite that way before with a presidential candidate, do you think that there's any downside to that, Scott Goodsting? Do you think that it in any way, because we are so used to having the president's words be accessible, that they're in any sense easier to ignore?
Now that everybody's on Twitter, how much is too much and what should be real is an interesting thought in the sense that it comes down to two points, transparency and authenticity. And as long as the president's message stays truly authentic and transparent, I think it's going to be fine.
Do you think the administration is listening to what people are saying online so that it works both ways?
I can't speak for the administration. I know that on the campaign, the part that I worked on, we were very quick to listen to what was happening and the messages that we were getting back from constituents on MySpace and Facebook and YouTube. And I think that politicians in general should be knowing that communication has changed drastically from one way of sending out a press release and putting up a TV spot and just assuming that you can just broadcast a message unilaterally to having to have a two-way conversation. I think in general that's good for democracy.
Mm-hmm. Well, you are going to be at this conference this week. What do you think will be the next big thing?
I don't know. I'm hoping to learn from the conference of what the next big thing is. I think that musicians have always been very creative in figuring out MySpace and figuring out how to build an email list and channels of distribution, because starving artists are very smart and clever in making sure that they can promote their music enough to survive. I'm going to be looking forward to learning more about being able to sell music and put out music on your own label and through your own website. And what lessons can politicians learn from being able to share more content freely?
Scott Goodstein is the founder of Revolution Messaging. He spoke with us here in our Washington, D.C. studio. Scott, it was a pleasure. Thank you.
Great. Thank you.
When Diane Schuler's car plowed into oncoming traffic on a New York State parkway in July, something shifted in the national consciousness about women and drinking. The suburban mother killed herself and seven other people, including her own two-year-old daughter and three nieces. She was driving with a blood alcohol level of 0.19%, the equivalent of almost 10 drinks. Her husband, Daniel Schuler, insisted that she didn't have a problem with alcohol.
If you are getting caught for a DUI, it does imply that that's not typically the first time that you have been behind the wheel drunk.
That's Sarah Allen Benton. She's a licensed mental health counselor at Emmanuel College in Boston and has written a book on alcoholism. She's a recovering alcoholic herself. She says alcoholics no longer fit a stereotype.
We have this image of the alcoholic being an old man, and suddenly this image is starting to shift and to change. And it's found that there's about 2.3 million American females who are alcoholic.
As women abuse alcohol more, they're also getting into more trouble on the road. A National Highway Traffic Safety Administration study released this summer showed that more women than ever are being arrested for driving under the influence, almost 30% more than in 1998. About 2,000 women a year are involved in fatal drunk driving accidents. Benton says many women don't realize when they've had too much to drink.
Low-risk drinking limits for women are 7 drinks per week, no more than 3 drinks in a sitting. Another misconception is what amount of alcohol, a glass of wine. You know, people pour a huge glass of wine and call that one drink. It's really 2 drinks.
We're joined now by two women who have battled alcoholism and written about their addiction. Mommy Doesn't Drink Here Anymore is blogger Rachel Brownell's account of getting through her first year of sobriety, a true account. And Blame is novelist Michelle Hunnevin's riveting story of a young woman who accidentally, while drunk, causes the death of 2 other people, a mother and a daughter, in her own driveway. Rachel and Michelle, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Jackie.
Thanks, Jackie. Nice to be here.
Rachel, let's begin with you. In some ways, you live the life that Michelle has written about. You certainly never killed anyone in a drunk driving accident. You weren't even arrested with a DUI. But you did live this kind of glamour girl high life for a while. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, in as much as someone from Bellingham, Washington can live a glamour girl high life, sure, you bet. You know, before I'm like a lot of my friends, I didn't have my kids until my mid-30s. So I had quite a few years to be a professional woman with not a lot of other responsibilities. So we would definitely take advantage of that and go out to galleries and dress up and drink and all that. And once I had kids and, you know, moved away from all of my social supports, I really became quite isolated, but also had a pretty demanding job and a demanding schedule as a mother. So it was a sort of a perfect storm of circumstance that really helped my alcoholism take off.
Yes, you say in the book that there's not a picture of you without a glass of wine in your hand, even as you're playing with your kids.
I know, it's charming, and I'm quite proud of that. You know, when my daughters were old enough to speak and they started playing games with mommy's wine this and mommy's wine that, that was one of those very embarrassing moments that happened that made me sort of pause and wonder about that.
Michelle Hunnevin, you are yourself a recovering alcoholic. This book has gotten some, I think, deserved wonderful reviews. First, tell us about your protagonist and heroine, Patsy McLemore, who we follow over her evolution of 20 years.
Well, Patsy is a tall, beautiful intellectual. She's a newly minted PhD, and she's a chronic alcoholic, and she's a blackout drinker. She's had plenty of DUIs, 3 or 4 by the time she wakes up in the Altadena Sheriff's Department, only to find out that she's been arrested for a double homicide, killing a mother and her daughter. And then in prison, once in prison, she begins attending AA meetings. She kind of goes in extremely reluctantly. Her father was a severe alcoholic as well, and she felt that AA took him away from their family. But she finally goes in because she needs to do something.
Let me open out a little bit to you, Rachel, because when you got into AA, it was a real struggle. Could you talk about that?
I grew up in an alcoholic home, and I had some exposure to 12-step groups. As a teenager, I started going to meetings with my mother. This was the late 70s, and my mom fancied herself a hippie, for sure, and she was. And so, you know, it's 10 in the morning, and there are people in our house, and they're all drinking. And I was reluctant to go to get help because I felt like I wasn't that bad. I'll be honest, I probably thought it was below me intellectually, and you know, when I pulled up and it was this rundown little building in the middle of an industrial area of my town, and I walk in and the carpet's stained and it smells, and I really felt like it was come down in the world. And, you know, so I was reluctant to become a part of it.
Michelle, what about your family?
Yes, and I would agree with Rachel that my mother was a big influence. She was someone who used, you know, a nice stiff glass of bourbon to relax. She would come home from work. I would hear her, the car door would slam, the front door would open, the cupboard door under the sink would open, and the bourbon bottle would be withdrawn. And as an adult, I thought that was my privilege as well.
You know, one of the things I noticed in both books is that Patsy, Michelle, is always surprised once she sobers up how little other people drink. And Rachel, you wrote in your book and on your blog that there were times when you felt you could drink your weight in wine.
Definitely. I think many things are surprising when you sober up, but I was pretty sure that people weren't drinking as much as me, but I had no idea how little they were drinking because I would prepare. You know, if I were going to a neighborhood party for a child, it was like at 4 in the afternoon, and I knew it wasn't going to be a big alcohol thing. I would drink beforehand, and I would make sure and bring my own wine to the event. And right, I was so checked out. I had no idea that people, sort of normal people, were not drinking every single day starting at 4 like I was.
What interests me is that we have both of you here, and one of you chose to write about what happened to you in a nonfiction way. And Michelle, you have a story to tell about alcoholism, which you have used in a work of fiction. Now, you're a novelist, but what do you think about the treatment of the subject in these two different ways, and why did you do it the way that you did?
I just never thought that my story was my own journey with alcoholism was particularly interesting. At the same time, I was interested in writing about someone who made a long 20-year journey with her alcoholism, largely because I was interested in examining kind of the moral questions involved.
What do you both think about the statistics that show that women are drinking more?
This is Michelle, and I'm not particularly surprised, or perhaps it's just they're drinking more publicly. Drinking is a remarkable automatic release and a way of relaxing. And as women find themselves juggling family and job and housekeeping and all of that, it's not surprising to me that they would reach for the most accessible, strong drug available.
This is Rachel. I wonder, I'm kind of with Michelle. I think there are a lot of societal pressures on women that didn't used to be there. I think that, you know, I talk a lot with my women friends about how we are supposed to have soulmate marriages, perfect children who speak two languages, a successful career. You know, I feel like the pressures and the things that we are supposed to be accomplishing are so insurmountable. It's really not a wonder to me that women turn to alcohol and pills and who knows what else to get them through.
Rachel Bronnell is the author of Mommy Doesn't Drink Here Anymore, and she's a mother of three who lives in Bellingham, Washington. Michelle Hunnevin is a novelist living in Altadena, California, and her latest novel is called Blame. You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. You can see why Christian conservatives might be in a bit of a funk. Democrats control the White House and both houses of Congress. So now Liberty Counsel, which is associated with the late Jerry Falwell's Liberty University, has launched an Adopt a Liberal program. And it's asking people to pray that God will steer leaders to the right. NPR's Barbara Bradley Haggerty has more.
As head of Liberty Counsel, Matt Staver spends his time fighting for Christian causes in court. He frets constantly about what he sees as the liberal drift of the country. So recently, he decided to pull out the heavy artillery. Prayer.
We believe in the power of God. We are commanded to pray for our leaders, even those that we disagree with. So we are asking people to pray so that poor leaders are restored to right thinking.
So far, the Adopt a Liberal program includes 11 leaders. There are two Republicans, Senator Olympia Snowe and Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger, for their stands on same-sex marriage, but most are Democrats, President Obama, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, and Congressman Barney Frank, who, Staver says, promotes a gay agenda.
But we also believe that Barney Frank was created in the image of God, and we ought to pray for him. So we believe in miracles.
Frank was unaware he was the object of prayer.
They didn't bother to tell me. Maybe they thought I would find out by revelation.
Frank doubts God is a conservative and says God certainly should not be used as a partisan weapon. Liberty Counsel is planning to create trading cards of liberals, which, like baseball cards, will have photos and information about him and others. Frank is intrigued.
In other words, if people got one of me, they could trade for like 11 Hillary Clintons and 3 Arnold Schwarzeneggers.
The only adopted liberal not in government is Matt Staver's nemesis, Barry Lynn, who runs the watchdog group Americans United for the Separation of Church and State.
As a Christian minister myself, I'm always happy to accept the prayers of other people, particularly when they're not calling for my death or dismemberment.
Lynn says this is way better than the prayers that some right-wing ministers have flung at him, that his teeth will fall out and his legs would break. He adds that he would defend Staver's prayerful attempt to convert him in court.
And one of the great things about our principle of separation of church and state is that people can pray for people whether they like it or not.
Still, Lynn says, Staver should not expect a political conversion for him or anyone on the list. Staver says he won't hold his breath, although he says some liberals, such as radio host Alan Combs, have asked to be put on the prayer list.
So anybody else who wants to be nominated on this list are free to do so. We would be happy to add you.
So just send some biographical information, and don't forget a picture. Barbara Bradley Haggerty, NPR News.
This is NPR News.